Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome a guest co-host today, Laurel Sisler, who is an outstanding clinical social worker who works in behavioral management and runs a lot of fascinating programs at the University of North Carolina. Welcome to Your Health, Laurel.
Thanks for having me.
You know, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Benjamin Summers, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Economics at Harvard School of Public Health, about the price of health care and rising premiums of Affordable Care Act. I suspect you see people who have some difficulties around premiums and cost of drugs in the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a timely issue. I'm looking forward to talking with him.
Yeah, but first, we're going to actually talk about some research that matters today. We're going to be able to talk about Zika virus, and are there times in which one should think about conception and getting pregnant that are different in the time of the year? We're talking about the diabetes prevention programs and cardiometabolic profiles, about ADHD medications, and something that I know you do because you counsel lots of patients about quitting smoking, about toxins in e-cigarette vapor. Really fascinating research.
It is, yeah. Yes.
Well, let's talk and dive into our very first research that matters about conception timed with the periods of low mosquito activity. Can that reduce Zika virus infection? What are they even talking about here?
They're talking about basically trying to plan when you get pregnant and in times when there are fewer mosquitoes in order to lower the chance of getting Zika virus while you're pregnant, which, of course, is the most harmful time to get pregnant.
And you may have some friends that are either trying to get pregnant or have recently gotten pregnant. I'm just guessing. Have you ever talked about this with your friends in terms of Zika virus? Is it on the radar screen of young women trying to get pregnant?
Yeah, it definitely is. I think in North Carolina, we're a little bit too far north, at least that's my understanding. But I was just joking, it's not very funny, though, about a friend who's currently in Florida. And my understanding is there is some risk there. And we were kind of joking about that a little bit this weekend, that we weren't sure if she knew that that was a risk in going down to Florida.
Well, and so this particular research that was really a prospective article published in the journal PLOS Plus Biology really talks about how, I guess, they've done other research on other viruses that have shown that these viruses peak at certain months of the year, and they're much lower at certain months of the year. I mean, we sometimes think that some of the viruses are lower in the winter, but some are higher in the winter, like flu virus. And that if you, particularly for viruses that can be passed on to other people, if you get pregnant at the lower times when the virus is not replicating or is active, then there's less transmission. And that maybe this is one way that we could decrease really transmission to babies of Zika virus and cut down. That seemed reasonable to me. What did you think, Laurel?
I think it seems really reasonable. I agree. I think it makes sense to, try and conceive in the times when there's fewer mosquitoes around.
You know, until we understand more, until we understand better ways, I think anyone who, particularly as Zika becomes more widespread across the United States, which it may well do, this is a better way of potentially trying to ensure you don't have that exposure. In addition to everything else, this doesn't say don't put on the mosquito block and don't do all of those other things. It just says this could lower the risk in a pretty simple way.
Yep. And it's a lot more reasonable, I think, for young families than being told, you don't try and have a baby for the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, who knows how many years this will continue being an issue. So
I think
a really good option.
Yeah, stay tuned. Well, speaking of staying tuned, this next research is something I know is near and dear to you, Laurel. And this is research that actually came out of Emory and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And it's looking at all of these studies, what they kind of call meta-analysis or systematic reviews, and they combine all these studies, in this case, 44 published studies with almost 9,000 adults looking at diabetes prevention programs.
So the Diabetes Prevention Program is a really long-term, quite intensive program focused around obviously preventing type 2 diabetes. It's centered around getting people more active and getting people to eat healthier. And it's multi-year, so very intensive, much more so than you think of for typical kind of health intervention programs. And I think that's part of the reason it's so successful. This particular research was looking at the fact that these programs, even if you don't achieve weight loss, which is one of the primary outcomes that they're measuring, even if you don't achieve that weight loss, you can, by getting more physically active, actually improve a lot of other health indicators such as blood sugar levels and blood pressure and things like that. And I think this is really promising. It's exciting because weight loss is very challenging. And so even if you don't achieve weight loss just by getting moving, by eating healthier, there are a lot of good benefits.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Laurel. It's very exciting. And because this also is not just in the research setting. These becomes more into the community-based settings. And we know that when you move out into the community away from the research environment, well, you may not be adhere to the study protocol as tightly, and they may not get as quite of a good a benefit. And they saw it here a little bit. They achieved less weight loss, but like you said, it was better blood glucose control, better blood pressure control, and cholesterol reductions. And it didn't seem like there was a lot of side effects here. And just so our listeners know, Laurel runs a very successful, new and exciting program at the University of North Carolina, a weight management program. So this is near and dear to your heart.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yep. Very similar to some of the groups that we're running and to the individual counseling that I provide at Family Medicine.
Yeah. So I think you should stay tuned. But I think looking out for diabetes prevention programs and maybe avoiding the medications, and even Medicare hopefully begins to start paying for this. This is a small piece, but an important one in this puzzle. Let's move on to our next research that matters, Laurel. And this is about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and the medication and whether the medication actually has benefits in reducing risky and perhaps sexual behavior, other behavior in children and teens. What type of things do you think about when you hear about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
Particularly regarding the medication, I think about a really tough decision from a parent's perspective. And this was really new research for me to learn about, in that there might be actually some benefits above and beyond just controlling the behavior in that moment and treating the issue in the moment. There might even be long-term benefits. And that was the first I'd heard of that.
Yeah, this was research on 150,000 children in South Carolina who had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder from 2003 to 2013. And they compared to children who didn't have, who had this diagnosis, and those who did and didn't receive medication. And those who had actually got the medication were 3.5% less likely to have a sexually transmitted disease, 7% less likely to have substance abuse disorder, and 2.5% less likely to be injured. And, you know, it raises the real question, which is, if you've got ADHD and you're not treated kind of appropriate, are you more likely to develop problems like this high-risk sexual behavior? It's not cause and effect, but it certainly suggests this is really worth looking at.
Or that treatment, it can be a helpful prevention strategy. It's similar to research I've heard about smoking, that treating ADHD, even in adults, can be a really critical piece of helping people quit smoking.
Yeah, and this was actually in the journal Labor Economics. And just real quickly, our last research that matter is about actually e-cigarette vapor, tobacco use in e-cigarettes, and a report that was in Research in the Environmental Science and Technology about some of the what's in the vapor when the actual compounds are heated, and then the vapor and the glycerin and what actually forms. Any cause of concern here?
Definitely. I think, electronic cigarettes are still an unknown entity. There is more and more research on what all the different compounds and chemicals and things are in there. And some of them are shown to be harmful, especially like this article is talking about when you have increased heat. And it makes me, thinking of people who use these products or are considering using them, the ones typically that people like a lot more are ones that are more similar to cigarettes and therefore heat up to higher temperatures. And so the ones that are more appealing to people may have actually more harmful chemicals in them.
Yeah, and these are just some of the common things that in normal things that aren't heated, glycerin, and propylene glycol, you know, but when they're heated and decomposition, that it could change them. Certainly calls for concern. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We'll take a short break, Laura, and when we return, we'll be talking to Dr. Benjamin Summers, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Economics at Harvard School of Public Health, about the price of health care, rising premiums for the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laura Sisler. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Today on Conversations, Laurel, we're talking with Dr. Benjamin Summers, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Economics at Harvard School of Public Health, about the price of health care, rising premiums for the Affordable Care Act. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Summers.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, you're a professor of health policy and economics, and I guess for our listeners, how did you become interested in this field? You're also a physician. How did you become interested in these sorts of fields?
Well, back when I was deciding what I wanted to do with my life, I knew that I was interested in medicine, and that had been a longstanding interest of mine. But as I started to kind of prepare to go to medical school and spend time with physicians and saw what their practices were like, I realized that I was interested in not just the one-by-one individual patient encounters, but also really thinking about the broader context and the policy and social and economic factors that affected not just how the encounters went, but even who got in the door, and whether or not some patients were not able to get the care they needed because of affordability. And that's really what pushed me to pursue training in health economics and ultimately to become a professor. Are doing both clinical care and researching healthcare issues.
That's something that I am very familiar with as a social worker as well, so overlapping interest there. Today we're talking about an article you wrote for the New England Journal of Medicine about the Affordable Care Act, a topic about which you've written extensively. What has it been like to study the evolution of the Affordable Care Act over the past few years?
It's been a really distinctive time to be doing research in health policy because essentially, short of the creation of Medicare and Medicaid 50 years ago, this is the single biggest change in healthcare, in the country's history, or certainly in our lifetimes. And so what this means is that there are so many questions to be explored and that we need good information on for policymakers as we figure out what parts of the law are working and what parts of the law could be improved. And so just the number and importance of the opportunities in research related to the ACA has been really exciting. But at the same time, there's been the unavoidable political controversy that's been percolating through every part of this law, even from before it was passed in the early days of the debate about the Affordable Care Act or what became the Affordable Care Act. And so that also shapes a lot of the discussion, even as a researcher now where I'm focusing on evidence and trying to analyze the data and examine what facts we can ascertain. It's colored through such a political context when people hear it. And we know that the ACA is seen very differently by people depending on their political affiliations. And that's a challenge, but also raises, I think, the importance of doing good research.
You know, it's interesting. I remember we had one of the great health economists, Stuart Altman, health policy experts, who you probably know on our show right after the Affordable Care Act was passed. And he helped kind of orchestrate some of the work there in Massachusetts that you're probably familiar with. And one of the things I remember that's, stuck with me when he was on the show, and this a couple of years ago, was that the Affordable Care Act was not designed to actually deal with cost. And like that was like this bombshell, like, oh, it wasn't. And he said, really, no, it was really designed to increase access. Is that true, really? And if so, was that like something that people just didn't know?
Well, it's hard to be a mind reader on this, but I'll tell you my opinion that when you hear the phrase Affordable Care Act, obviously people think about healthcare costs. But there are really two distinct perspectives in talking about affordability. One is how much individual people pay for their care. And then the other is how much as a society, through both public and private spending, we're spending on healthcare. a lot of people, when they talk about making healthcare affordable or dealing with healthcare costs, are thinking about the latter, about how much we're spending total and whether we can drive down the cost of healthcare. And I don't think the Affordable Care Act's primary focus was that. But I do think the kind of the everyday household decision-making, how much people are paying when they want to go see the doctor, that part was very much the focus of the Affordable Care Act. If you have no insurance, healthcare is not affordable. If you have health insurance, and if you, particularly if you have good health insurance, you can see the doctor when you need to, you can get the testing done, you can fill your prescriptions, and it's much more affordable, and we know that people are less likely to delay the care they need. So if you frame it in that way, I think the Affordable Care Act was a lot about healthcare costs, but it was about healthcare costs to the consumer, to the average person. Now, what Stuart Altman, I think, is referring to in terms of the overall healthcare costs and this notion of bending the cost curve to try to hold down healthcare spending, there is some aspect of the Affordable Care Act that tries to explore that. It wasn't the focus. The bulk of the law really was expanding coverage and making it affordable for people to get the care they need. But there are parts of the law that are trying to find new ways to pay for healthcare, to try to figure out if we can be more efficient in what we provide to people. And that's an ongoing effort, but the Affordable Care Act is certainly not the last word on either of those issues, both coverage expansion and total affordability or total cost of care. But I agree with the general statement. When you look at what the main accomplishments to date of the ACA, it's been the expansion of health insurance to 20 million Americans who would otherwise be uninsured.
Dr. Summers, I'm making an assumption here, but wouldn't that consumer, bringing the cost down for consumers, would that not long term, if people are getting preventative health care and doing going to the doctor when they need to, would that save costs long term?
You know, it's a great question, and it's been a topic of a lot of debate. Certainly some of the supporters of the Affordable Care Act or of coverage expansion more generally have offered that up as one rationale. There's not a lot of evidence to support that, and the simple reason for that is when you make care affordable, people use a lot more of it. But that's actually a good thing as a doctor, that when my patients are sick, they're willing to come in and be seen because they're not worried that they can't afford it. When they get prescriptions for medications that I think that they should take for their health, that they're willing to fill them and stay on the medications. So in general, the research shows that when people get health insurance, they spend more. They are more likely to see the doctor, they're more likely to take prescriptions, they're more likely to go to the hospital, and in many cases, they're more likely to go to the emergency room. And that doesn't mean that the care is bad. In fact, it's probably the opposite. We are helping people get the care that they need. But that does cost more money. Now, I think there's somewhat of an unrealistic expectation about expanding health insurance. We don't generally assume in other areas of the economy that we're going to spend and actually save money in the long run. You know, if we want to invest in good highways, we spend money for that. If we want to invest in good schools, we spend money for that. If we want to invest in better health care and good health, we usually would expect to spend money on that. So the notion that we would get to expand coverage to millions of people and save money is probably not realistic, but is a different standard that we don't really hold other policies to. I view this as an investment that you can invest in people, spend more money on their health care, but hopefully have them feeling better and certainly having better access to the care that they need.
You know, when we think about your article about the Affordable Care Act and premium increases, the title, The Sky Isn't Falling, it's interesting, and it makes me think of several things, and I'd like to hear kind of some of your thoughts about what you meant by that. But it seems like any patient that I've had, whether they are very wealthy or not so wealthy, it seems like the one thing they can agree on is they want to pay as little out of pocket as possible. And so when premium increases go up, it seems like it affects all of them and none of them are happy. And they seem to all blame the ACA, but yet the ACA wasn't the cause of most of those problems. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, there's a story that I've read, and I don't know if it's true or not, but it certainly makes sense, which was that early on in the discussions and actually at the passage of the Affordable Care Act, people in the White House and the supporters of the law essentially recognized that from here on out, they own everything that happens in healthcare, meaning that by passing the ACA, for better or for worse, any change in the system was going to get chalked up to that law. And I think that that's true. I think a lot of people, if they see their premiums go up, even if their coverage is through their employer and has been largely unaffected by the Affordable Care Act, there's an inclination to say, oh, this must be related to Obamacare. Well, the simple truth is that premiums have essentially gone up steadily for as long as they've been followed. Every once in a while, there is a few year period where they flatten out, but then premiums continue to go back up. And that's part of what the paper that I wrote was about. just recognizing this reality that premium increases are an inherent part of our healthcare system, in large part because of new technologies coming out, and also the steady increase of prices over time. And so when you take those two things into account, you have to understand context when you're interpreting changes that go on from here on out. And so some of the premium increases are related to the Affordable Care Act. And in particular, if you look at the marketplaces, those were created by the law. And so how premiums are changing year to year has a lot to do with the structure of these marketplaces and whether the policy is working in different parts of the country. The majority of the coverage in our country still comes from other sources, people getting it through their employer, people who are on Medicare, people getting Medicaid based on eligibility even before the ACA. And for most people paying premiums in the private market, premiums do go up year to year, and that's not really new under the Affordable Care Act. Now, are there some reasons that the premiums are going up more in certain places under the ACA? Yes. And if we look at the changes in the policy in the ACA, there are a couple pieces that were enacted originally that were meant to protect against big premium increases and to protect the insurance companies against high costs of care from sicker patients.
Dr. Summers, we're going to need to take a short break, so we're going to just put a pause in that, and then we're going to come right back in. So we will take a short break, but then we'll continue with our guest, Dr. Benjamin Summers, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Economics at Harvard School of Public Health, about the price of healthcare, rising premiums for the Affordable Care Act. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and myself, Laurel Sisler. We've been talking to Dr. Benjamin Summers, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Economics at Harvard School of Public Health, about the price of healthcare, rising premiums, and the Affordable Care Act. Just before we left, Dr. Summers, you were talking a little bit about why some folks may actually be experiencing increased premiums under the Affordable Care Act, but we haven't really gotten to the main point in your article, which is that maybe even though it appears as though premiums are rising, that might not necessarily be true. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, the premiums are rising, but the question is by how much, and how much out of the kind of historical norm is this? And part of what I do in the paper is go through the past 3 years, and every spring we've seen newspaper articles predicting very large increases in premiums and often describing these changes as evidence that the ACA is really not working or is potentially, you know, on the cusp of falling apart. And then 6 months later, by the time the open enrollment period begins, when people actually go on to the marketplaces under the ACA and sign up for coverage, most of those dire predictions have turned out to not be the case. Now, why is that? Well, this is early on in the process. So in the spring, the insurance companies propose their bids as to how much they want to charge for the upcoming year. But that's not the final word, because the ACA requires any insurer that's proposing an increase of more than 10% in their premiums to undergo a rate review where they actually have to justify whether that price increase can be really deserved. And about one in three consumers in 2015 actually were in plans where those premium increases were blocked or reduced during this review process. There's also the competitive portion of what goes on in these marketplaces, that these original bids will get revised as the plans see what other plans are doing. And if an insurance company way overprices, they're going to lose their market. And so we see that competition in particular in places that have multiple plans in the same area, that should drive down those final prices. And probably most importantly is that most consumers don't pay for the full price of their policies that they get through the marketplace. Over 80% are qualifying for the ACA's premium tax credits. And what that does is gets them a federal income tax credit that's applied at the time they buy the insurance. And so when they pick out a plan, they don't pay the majority of that price. Depending on their income, the federal government picks up a large part of that tab. And what that means is that if prices go up, the tax credit often will take up the majority of that premium increase, or even all of it in some cases. So you take all of this together, and what it says is the spring reports of big premium increases, by the time we get to November, December, the premium increases are usually much smaller, and many consumers aren't even paying it themselves. So I think that's the main focus of this article, is just not to get too alarmed by the numbers early on. And past experience says by the time consumers are signing up, there will be some increases, but they won't be nearly as dramatic.
You know, I don't know about the rest of the country, but let me just give you two kind of examples of some of the things that we face here and just see your thoughts. I know in North Carolina that rather than increased competition, we probably have decreased competition. Major insurers like Blue Cross Blue Shield potentially leaving the whole exchange. And so we have that has an impact on, of course, on this competition. And the second piece is the employer burden or understanding. My wife being a medium business owner, a doctor who has to burden lots of the costs willingly, but those costs have not actually been moderated. And so how do you respond from kind of different perspectives of how this you would kind of added onto the article some pieces? Were they follow the same line?
Well, so there certainly is a lot of difference across states. And so, Adam, I think your point's well taken. And North Carolina does have a fairly small number of providers in the marketplace. I think it was three in 2016, as according to some numbers from the Kaiser Family Foundation. And so when you have fewer insurance companies, that certainly makes the competition not as strong a factor in holding down prices. But in general, most consumers are in areas that have multiple plan offerings, and so there is that competition. And in many states, we see, you know, 5-10 plans competing in the marketplace. And so, you know, new plans enter, old plans leave, and keeping track of the kind of the total exit and entry is important. And you're right that in some places that's not as robust as we'd like, and I think policymakers are trying to figure out how to keep enough competition in the marketplace to make it successful everywhere. In terms of the employer side of this, there are some parts of the ACA that affected the coverage that employers provide, but the bulk of the new regulations really relate to what people get when they go on the marketplaces or if they get so-called individual insurance, when they go through a broker or they go directly to an insurance company but aren't getting it through work. For the most part, there have been very few changes that have been shown up yet in any of the studies looking at employer data and employer coverage. Most people who get their coverage through work are still getting it, and there hasn't been a big shift away from employer coverage as some of the law's critics proposed and suggested would happen. But that doesn't mean there aren't cost issues, because as I said earlier, healthcare costs tend to go up year to year, and in particular, as the economy improves, we're likely to see costs start to accelerate again. They were pretty flat for the last couple of years in the aftermath of the Great Recession and the financial collapse. And as the economy picks up, healthcare spending usually picks up as well. And so that is something worth keeping an eye on. That's not necessarily a result of the ACA, but certainly is shaping many people's experiences with healthcare in the upcoming year.
Do you have any tips for our listeners who might be shopping on the Affordable Care Act exchange in the coming year?
Yeah, the first and probably most important message is to make sure to do that shopping, to be careful and thoughtful about it, because you had a plan, maybe it worked well for you last year, maybe it didn't, but its price may be going up significantly, and there might be new options available to you that turn out to be more affordable. The tax credit amount relates to your income, so if you've had changes in your income, you want to make sure you put that information in so you get the updated cost estimates of how much your plan would cost. And the other factor is, you know, cost isn't the only thing you should be looking at. These plans differ both in terms of how much they cover and also in the networks that they cover. So if you have particular providers that you are seeing and you want to see you want to stick with the same doctor, stick with the same specialist, you really want to look at that information before you make a final decision. And similarly, if there's certain treatments or certain medications you want to make sure are covered without cost sharing, that's something else you want to really focus on, because you know, the dollar values are really easy to notice. The premium's the first thing you'll see when you look up a plan, but it's not the only thing that's going to determine how much you spend overall and whether you're satisfied with that coverage.
You know, I think we have like two more questions, and one of them is, what would cause you to be worried, and what's the kind of the red flag for you that this is, that something could be abnormal? And I remember talking recently with a medical director of a medium-sized plan up in the Northeast who said, you know, they hadn't really budgeted and planned for the fact of so many of these new medications, like the liver hepatitis C medications that could be a couple $100,000, and all these people coming on board and taking advantage in the cost. Are there some red flags that you would say, boy, we really better dive in and address this?
Yeah. So I think the two things I would look at, the first is how much are the premiums going up? And in the paper, we talk about, I talk about what the historical rates of increase were in these individual insurance plans, which before the ACA in 2008, 2009, going up around 10% each year. And at least in the first couple of years of the ACA, the exchange premium increases have been much lower than that, under 4%, according to some estimates. If the numbers start jumping back up to, you know, 10, 15%, and not just for 1 year, but consistently in that range, that starts to become a much more problematic issue, and you'd want to look at some of the additional policy solutions there. And then related to the point you raised earlier, Adam, which is if there are a number of states or a number of counties where people's options are really just one, if they don't have enough different insurance plans to pick from, that there is no competition, that itself is also going to be problematic. And so if we see areas where they're either zero or one provider of insurance, that suggests that the marketplace isn't really supporting the kind of competition it needs to for the long term. So those would be two red flags that would say we need to really revisit this. But if I can, I think that relates to a broader point about the ACA. Most big laws and complicated laws get implemented, and then legislators work to figure out what parts are going well and what parts aren't and try to improve it. That hasn't happened with the Affordable Care Act. The political rhetoric has been so divisive that all we've seen are attempts to repeal it entirely and attempts to defend it. And there's been no meaningful compromise or attempts to kind of build on the parts that are successful or revise the parts that aren't succeeding. And the sooner we can get away from the overheated rhetoric and actually look at what parts of the law are going well and which parts could be improved, the better the healthcare system will work for everybody.
Well, Dr. Benjamin Summers, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Economics at Harvard School of Public Health, on behalf of Your Health, we really want to thank you for talking about not just the price of healthcare, the rising premiums, but really both providing some reassurance, also some challenges, and hopefully some solutions. Thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us.
My pleasure, and thanks again for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laura, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listeners' health questions and concerns. And, of course, if a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we've got the great pleasure of welcoming our new executive producer, Laura Lacey, to Your Health. Welcome to Your Health, Laura.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, we are thrilled and lucky to have you. You come from a really storied and really strong background in journalism and production and have some great ideas on how to strengthen your health. So we're really looking forward to introducing you to our listeners and our listeners to you.
Well, that's so kind of you to say, and I'm very excited about working with you guys.
Well, we are too. And first, got some great house calls we're going to talk about today. What's our very first house call?
I have been on pain medications for 20 years, and my doctor recently said I had to cut back. It has not been easy, but I'm slowly doing it, and I can say for the first time in 10 years that my stomach is feeling better. Just wanted to share.
Wow. Well, that's a really important story, and I guess it's one that we don't talk about too much on Your Health. We kind of hear the problems of either someone taking too much opioid medication and having an overdose, or we're saying don't be on opioid medication because you don't want to get addicted, or you're on opioid medication and you're doing well. This is kind of a variation on that theme.
Yeah, my first question would be, what type of pain medication? You assumed opioids. Is that? I guess we don't know, but to me, that would be my first question.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct, and I think what you're hinting at is that if you've been on long-term opioid therapy, getting off of it is not so easy. And I think, you know, in this particular circumstance, a physician had some concerns that the stomach problems, which can include kind of your stomach just not working, it's kind of like the opioids kind of, well, we know they cause constipation. You probably hear this from a lot of the patients you see.
Yes.
Counseling, Laura.
Yeah, and I think as an addiction professional, I would be curious if her doctor gave her any guidance about how to taper off, because I think that is sometimes where issues can occur, where you start to experience withdrawal symptoms because you've been on a medication for so long and you are physically dependent on it. So it sounds like she did not have any of those issues. But if anybody else is in a similar position, just be aware that you may experience some withdrawal effects, and you might need to have some assistance from a professional in order to kind of taper off safely.
Yeah, it's a great point. We sometimes say that you can maybe cut back 10%, and, you know, every couple of weeks, every month. I mean, you really got to work on this. This is not like addiction to the benzodiazepines like Ativan and Clonopin, which actually have to be tapered off for months and months and months frequently if you've been on it for a long term. But we're so glad to hear of the success for a lot of our patients that are on long-term opioids who want to perhaps get down on them or maybe need to. This is a good lesson. Thanks for sharing. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm 50 years old, and I'm really overweight. I've tried everything. My doctor has recommended bariatric surgery, but I've resisted. But I'm beginning to think my doctor's right because nothing else is working.
Wow. Well, Laurel, this is something that's near and dear to you. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you actually do, a lot of your day-to-day work right now.
Yeah, so I'm a social worker, and I'm working right now at UNC Family Medicine, starting up weight management programs. So one program I work at Family Medicine, providing individual counseling, and I see many patients just like this. And I think my first question would be kind of, what have you tried before? Because often people are frustrated, but there might actually be things that they haven't tried. Or more commonly, it might be an issue where you've actually tried and have been successful, but the issue is that weight regain then occurs. And so you're kind of in a yo-yo of, okay, something works for a while, but it doesn't work forever. And so I think it's important to or helpful with people like this person who's calling in to help identify what are some more sustainable ways that we can maybe not lose as much weight, but lose, you know, anywhere between 5% and 10%, but actually have success in keeping it off.
Yeah, those are great points. And we also have to recognize that not everyone, even despite having the best expertise available and the best coaching and even some of the medications, they may not be able to do that. And
yes,
and in some cases, that's where that bariatric surgery can actually really be effective. And it is one of the most effective. And so it may well be, if you've already gone through all the things that Laurel talks about and you've done it for a while, the doctor maybe has some inkling that this was going to be necessary for lots of reasons. And so I think revisiting, it is a team-based approach. You're hearing it now, and I think your story is an important one for our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. I think bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery is underutilized, and it's one of the most effective ways to help with type 2 diabetes as well as a lot of other health issues.
What's our very last house call, Laura?
I have diabetes, and my doctor recommended medication. However, it's not too bad, and I really want to try to lose weight first. I'm also on a medication that can raise my blood sugar, and I'm wondering if I can switch to a different medication.
Wow, really good questions today. You know, we oftentimes, I think, we see someone has a elevated blood pressure, we see someone who has a elevated blood sugar, and as doctors, we sometimes think, oh, let's start you on a medication. Laurel, you don't prescribe medications, but you work with providers who do. I suspect your first thing isn't always, let's start them on medication. What do you think about?
Certainly with both of those issues, blood pressure and blood sugar, getting physically active, even if it doesn't result in weight loss, can be helpful and have an impact, a positive impact on blood pressure and blood sugar. Also, losing between 5 and 10% of your current body weight can also be a really effective strategy. The other thing to consider, too, if this person is on a medication that might be contributing to their weight or their blood sugar, that would be a really important conversation to have with their doctor.
Yeah, there are some medications. We don't know which medication this patient was on, but there's some medications that are used for blood pressure that can raise your blood sugar. There's some medications that are used for people who have psychosis or other sorts of problems like that can raise your blood sugar. So I think finding out, can you take a different medication, which is a great question, that physical activity, some weight loss. Boy, you know, those seem like great things to be able to do rather than immediately let's add another medication on. And in this case, maybe that's indicated. We'd want to work with you, not against you. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us for your health. We hope you've addressed issues and concerns important to you. And you can share your questions and stories. Email them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my great guest co-host Laurel Sisler, and our guest today, Dr. Benjamin Summers. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And Laurel Sisler.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Thank you.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.